Good afternoon, Juneau. It's just about 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore going to be your host today for Juneau Afternoon, and I have a wonderful lineup of guests today. Vic Fisher, who was on the show yesterday, is still in town, and we're going to take advantage of that to bring him back and talk a little bit more about his new book that's available in town all over called To Russia With Love. He'll be talking a couple of places yet before we send him away to the next adventure in his life. And Tom Cosgrove will drop by. He's doing a presentation on grief this week, and he'll tell us about that. Megan Grunau will be here to tell us about Saturday's Rotaract Masquerade Ball, and we'll learn about the fireside lecture at Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. It's called A Sea of Otters. James Bodkin will be here to tell us about that, and Mark Stoffel will drop by and tell us about the film festival that's coming up for the Juneau Watership Partnership Film Festival. It's the National Film Festival, part of it brought to Juneau each year. For the rest of today, we're looking at cloudy with scattered rain showers. The high is around 39, southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. We'll be back with Vic Fisher right after National Native News.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Minister of Aboriginal Affairs, John Duncan, is resigning from his job. Dan Karpinchuk has more from Canada.
Duncan said he was stepping down because he improperly wrote a letter to a tax court on behalf of one of his constituents. The move couldn't have come at a worse time. The government has publicly committed to a new round of talks over treaty issues and land claim settlements, and the leadership from the Department of Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development will certainly take on a much higher profile. The interim leader of the opposition Liberal Party, Bob Ray, says Duncan led a very important portfolio.
It's a big job. The Aboriginal Affairs portfolio is a tough and complicated job. It's become much, I think, probably one of the most difficult posts in government and in Canadian public life today. May have proven too much for Mr. Duncan.
Some Native leaders, however, have called Duncan's resignation nothing more than a diversion, especially as Aboriginal issues gain significance on the national stage. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Duluth, Minnesota's appeal was denied in federal court this week in its ongoing litigation against the Fond du Lac Band over casino revenues. The tribe's looking forward to moving on, while the city's attorney told reporters the decision was no surprise and other court options will be looked at. Dan Huckelack from WGZS reports.
A three-judge panel ruled in favor of the Fond du Lac Band in January. The City of Duluth then filed an appeal for the Eighth Circuit Court to rehear the case by the entire panel of judges. That appeal was also denied. This latest ruling by the Court of Appeals upholds a lower court ruling and a ruling by the National Indian Gaming Commission. Since that agreement was signed in 1986, the band has paid the City of Duluth approximately $75 million. Fond du Lac Tribal Chairwoman Karen Diver says that repeated attempts to reach an out-of-court settlement with the city have been unsuccessful despite the city suffering a string of legal defeats.
I think that the overriding feeling of the Reservation Business Committee is just that, you know, it's looking forward to a time when it can put this behind us, focus on our business enterprise, you know, perhaps give Fond du Lac a much-needed facelift, continue to partner with other businesses in downtown Duluth the way we have been.
For National Native News, I'm Daniel Huckelack.
A tribal elder and beloved bird singer from southern Arizona has died. KAWC's Maya Springhawk Robnett reports.
Willard Golding, Kwatsan tribal elder and head bird singer, passed away Tuesday at 70 years old from complications with pneumonia. Part of the Roadrunner clan, Golding spent his life on the Fort Yuma Reservation. Bossman, as he was often called, taught five generations of bird singers and was the head bird singer for more than half a century. Kendrick Escalante, the president of Kwatsan Radio, says Golding took him under his wing. As head bird singer, Golding sang at every funeral. Who now will sing at his?
I wouldn't be surprised if every singer who has a voice won't be there. I know the Roadrunner family that he's a part of will be there. They will mourn for him, but I have a feeling they'll sing for him too. And I'll be there and I'll sing for him, and many, many bird singers will be there to sing for him. So I'm really not worried about who's going to sing for him. It's a matter of where they're all going to sit.
Bossman passed on his love of tradition to all the Colorado River tribes. Keeney Escalante, president of the Kwatsan tribe, says he will be greatly missed.
I don't know. Sometimes I'm just lost for words, but he was a person to look up to, and he was always willing to set aside his situations and help out, you know. We'll definitely miss him.
Golding will be laid to rest on Sunday. For National Native News, I'm Maya Springhawk, Robnett.
During this week in 1941, Cree singer-songwriter Buffy St. Marie was born. The Native woman is known for her protest and love songs, as well as being an educator, artist, and advocate for Indigenous people. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, with funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIC-CLIC-GIVE when filing online for your PFD. When you select KNBA-FM, Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, you support National Native News. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Well, it's been said that Vic Fisher's new book is a spy novel crossed with the history of Alaska and a dissertation on the Constitution and all sorts of things. We have him here, and he can speak for himself. Welcome to the program again, Vic. You were on yesterday, I think, too.
Thank you, Pat. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you so much for coming down to the studio again. I understand we might be joined by your wife as we get further into the interview. I hope so.
I hope she shows up. I told her we'd be on at 3:30, so she may not make it.
Oh, well, if not, I'm sure she's having a delightful time here in Juneau as well. So yesterday, Matt Miller talked to you, I think, about a lot of the stuff, a lot of the material in the first part of the book, and I kind of wanted to move toward the second half of the book, because there's a place in there where the book kind of pivots because of your more or less your second career. After a lot of service in the state of Alaska, you became you returned again to Russia and had a long period of time there where you were basically helping the countries, particularly on the Russian Far East, sort of recover their economies or begin recovering their economies after such a long period of time without any kind of free market abilities at all. I think you were almost teaching free market economics to people in Kyrgyzstan, and I'm not sure what the other towns were. I know Magadan was the big city.
Yeah, it was Magadan and Yakutsk and Khabarovsk and Yuzhno-Sakhalinsk and Vladivostok, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, in the process of that, by the way, you engineered the deal, I think, where Russian students could get in-state tuition in Alaska at Alaskan institutions, and for a while there we had a huge influx of Russian students in all of our higher education.
I was part of the effort of linking Alaska with the Russian Far East, and there were a number of people involved, and it was a very exciting period after the ice curtain melted between us and the others on the other side of the Bering Strait, and we built essentially bridges of science and in education and technical assistance of all sorts. And underlying it all was a change that was taking place in Russia after Gorbachev toward democratization, decentralization of power to the regions, to the cities. And it was very, very exciting to be there. And there was excitement on the Alaska side and the Russian side.
Well, I'm surprised you remember much of it because you were drunk most of the time.
Well, it was,
there was a lot of vodka to be.
There was vodka flowed very freely, and it certainly helped cement a lot of friendships.
It is amazing the role that plays. It's very undervalued in what it is, but you have to drink in order to do this stuff.
Right. It's all to peace and friendship. And so we had both peace and we had friendship.
So I want to turn from there. You're going to be talking at two venues while you're here, and we should be sure we say this at least a couple of times. Your next appearance this evening is at the Sound and Motion event up at the University of Alaska Southeast, and that's at 7 o'clock in Egan Lecture Hall. And that's been kind of billed as an open conversation. I think you're going to be doing a kind of a question and answer thing up there as well as delivering something of a talk. And then the second presentation that people can take in is Saturday at Holy Trinity, and that's at 7 o'clock. And the theme of that one is entitled Hopes and Dreams of the Alaska Constitution Today. So this harks back to the period of time when you were actually one of the authors of the Alaska Constitution. Right. But returning to Russia now, it seems to me in many ways that we are going through a period of confusion in our relationship with Russia. And in particular, the previous outgoing Secretary of State attempted this recalibration of our relationships with Russia, which appears to have fallen on its face. And now we read in the newspaper on a frequent basis that Russia is backing Assad in Syria, and they're backing the Iranians, and It's almost as though there's a little bristling that goes back to the terrible period of the Cold War. Do you feel that's going on, or what's your take on current Russian-American relations?
I think in part you're right. Secretary Clinton was trying to reestablish friendly relations with Russia, and I think that essentially it did not fit in with Putin's programs. His goal was to strengthen Russia, to have Russia be a big player on the world scene, and being cuddly with Americans didn't fit them. And it was scary in terms of internal affairs because Americans were sticking their nose into democratic institutions, and there's a new Russian nationalism that Putin is trying to promote, and an anti-Americanism. Last year, a law was adopted by the Russian Congress, the Duma, literally said that any organization, nonprofit or other, that receives foreign money has to declare itself an agent of a foreign power. I mean, just think of it. A nonprofit organization dealing with technical assistance or with communication, media, anything, honest voting, good lawful conduct, would have to declare itself an agent of a foreign nation. No organization can do that. So that just helped. There was almost the final exclamation mark on excluding relations with the non-Russian world. And that's been the policy. America is increasingly shown as a devil in the world, trying to dominate the world. I think there'll be limits on it in terms of Winter Olympics being held in Russia. And they'll act nice, just like the Chinese did during the period of their Olympics. And the latest is complete stopping of adoptions of Russian children by Americans. Today and yesterday, the Russians accused a couple in, I don't know what state in the United States, of murdering their three-year-old child. So we're the devil incarnate, and this is a way of building up Russia, and it's mostly for internal consumption, but it's at the expense of America-Russian relations.
Vic, is there a prescription here? Do you have an idea of what we should do in our foreign relations with Russia?
Well, I think we ought to keep talking with them. There's a lot going on at the technical level. There's real collaboration on Arctic issues, Arctic Ocean issues. There are programs of pollution control, bilateral agreements between U.S. and Russia at the highest levels. They just established, moved ahead with the Beringer Park concept that was initially established by the presidents of U.S. and Russia in 1989. I mean, this is implementing something. So there are some bilateral steps like that that are going on, search and rescue, where the military and civilian authorities on both sides have been collaborating for years. There's a lot of bilateral activity going on sea mammal management on both sides of the Bering Strait. So there's a lot going on, but when it comes to social issues, democratization, Putin does not want anything that might support dissent on the Russian side.
Are you anticipating going back to Russia?
Oh, I've been back. I go back. I have friends and some family there. And
are your brothers still living there?
I have a brother who lives in Moscow, and mm-hmm. We communicate regularly, telephone, email, and in person. I saw him last year and the year before, and Jane and I were in Providenia and Russia on the Chukotka side of the Bering Strait. And so we visit Moscow and St. Petersburg. On a person-to-person basis, it's still a fabulous thing. Mm. Because these official policies create bad relations, but personal ties, they're still paramount.
Vic, we could talk all day. Matt said the same thing at the end of his conversation with you yesterday, and I second the motion. I could talk with you, but there is a chance to talk with you tonight, and we want to make sure that people know that at 7 o'clock this evening in the Egan Lecture Hall up on the UAS campus, you'll be doing the Sound and Motion presentation and signing copies of your books and allowing people to ask questions and hopefully carrying on the same kind of conversation we've had for the last couple of days with you on the air here.
And tomorrow as well.
Yeah, and then Saturday at Trinity, at Holy Trinity Church, Hopes and Dreams of the Alaska Constitution Today, presentation there also at 7 p.m. tomorrow
right.
evening. So, Vic, thank you so much for taking time out of a busy schedule for you. And I wish Jane had had a chance to join us. But
I might mention that anyone who cannot be there for the talk and book signing can get copies of the book at Hearthside bookstores, as well as they can go on the web and at vicfisher.org they can order a signed copy of the my autobiography.
Outstanding. Okay, well, thank you so much. The book is called To Russia with Love. We'll close with a little more of the theme of From Russia with Love.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Pat.
We'll be right back. If the end of winter doldrums has snared you, and even if they haven't, it's time to dance the winter dark away at the Barn Dance this Saturday, February 23rd, 7:30 p.m. at St. Anne's Parish Hall downtown at 5th and Gold. We'll dance to music by the Full Circle String Band. Greg Berger, Mary DeSmet, and Doug Smith will play lively jigs and reels and lovely waltzes, and Tom Paul will teach and call contra and square dances. You don't need any experience or partner, just be ready for a fun and friendly atmosphere. Student and senior discounts and free for SAG and JVs. Barn Dance, Saturday.
Checking the weather forecast, let's check the time first. It's 20 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore here hosting Juneau Afternoon today. Coming off of a conversation with Vic Fisher, let's say it one more time. He's doing the Sound and Motion talk tonight at UAS up in the Eagan Lecture Hall at 7 o'clock, and tomorrow he's doing a talk at Holy Trinity at 7 p.m. called Hopes and Dreams of the Alaska Constitution Today. So a couple of chances to see him and possibly get a signed copy of his new book, To Russia with Love. Looks like the weather cloudy. We're talking about scattered rain showers, highs around 39, southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy, scattered rain and snow showers, low around 32, and northwest winds 10 miles per hour. Those will shift around to the southeast late tonight. So my next guest is doing, he's a storyteller, and normally he does kind of funny things, and this one is maybe a stretch. I'm not sure. Tom, you're doing...
I don't know. You're not giving me credit to say it's a stretch.
Okay.
No, the topic...
Tom Cosgrove, anyway.
Thank you very much.
Storyteller extraordinaire.
Thank you. It's called Healing Through Stories Beyond Death and Loss. And, you know, people say, well, what is this? And I guess my pithy little answer is it's a safe place to contemplate our common fate. And it's a place where you can also remain consistent with whatever belief system you have. This is really coming out of a place that this is an experience we all are going to have, and yet we never talk about it.
I can't remember who it was on the radio the other day, said, I'm going to have a cardiac arrest in my life, and all of us will have one of those, guaranteed.
It's where we're all going. And from a storyteller's point of view, I mean, this is the most powerful story there is. I mean, it encompasses, you know, our greatest fears, some of our biggest challenges, and life's biggest mysteries. So it's a great opportunity. And so how this is going to work, basically, is that I'm going to share a few stories. And one of which I'm going to talk about my experience with my father as he died, and I'm going to debut a story that I'm really excited about. It's about my mother's experience with medical marijuana. And so I've got a series of stories, and afterwards we're going to open it up to let people share their stories, if they'd so wish.
What's the venue? Where are you at?
We're at Northern Light United Church.
Okay.
And that's downtown at 11th and B Street. Mm-hmm. It's going to be Sunday, 7 p.m., Northern Light United Church, 11th and B, downtown.
Is there a charge?
There's no charge at all.
Oh, okay.
And as a matter of fact, we're also going to be live streaming. If you want to go to the Northern Light, northernlightchurch.org, there is a link on there that is called Live Stream. So if you want to check this out, and you really don't want to go into a community place, you can go to northernlightchurch.org, hit on the live stream link, and you do have to set up something. You got to get an account before you can go, but you'll be able to see it live there. So,
now, is the Foundation for the End of Life Care, are they partially sponsoring this?
Yeah, they are.
Okay.
Foundation End of Life and Northern Light Church are both sponsoring it. And and it's really kind of a grassroots movement. This came out of an idea that Jenny Palmer had, who's the author of When You're Not Here.
Mm-hmm.
And one of her, and in her book, she used little vignettes, little stories to kind of illustrate points. And she's always been interested in tying it to storytelling. And Pastor Phil Campbell over at Northern Light United Church put us together. I had worked with Phil on a couple other projects, and this is what came out of it. And it's pretty exciting. There are powerful stories, but they're also they're uplifting. And if you listen to these stories, what happens is that it really I don't want to say desensitizes you to death, but it really makes it more natural, less mysterious, and it should be. You know, it was just a generation or so ago where, you know, you were born in the same house, you lived there, and you died there, and your wake was in the living room. And we are far from that now. Most of us rarely witness death and rarely talk about it outside of a grief support network.
Mm-hmm.
So it's exciting from my point of view. And I, you know, I'm glad you said that, okay, this, I usually tackle humorous subjects. And I want to tell you that there is a few laughs in here, you know, and because it's, you know, I think there is humor in all every subject.
Death is not handled well in our media. I'm thinking of a number of movies where basically at the instant that the person is dying peacefully, not the ones where someone is being blown all over the landscape, everyone looks away. The camera pulls away and we never see the death. You know, it's usually not something that's on, unless it's on the battlefield, in which point then we have to see the eyes change from focus to non-focus because we have to know that, you know, the horrible things happen. And it's the horrible thing happening that becomes really, I think, the subject for the cinematographer. I'm trying to think if I've ever seen a film where death was handled with that naturalness, and it's not.
I don't think so.
We don't have that. We don't have a tool for, because we learn so much about how to live.
Sure, our images are manufactured by the media, and since we don't have this experience that other generations have, we're kind of, you know, we're needing to create it on our own. And I've been talking to people. One of the things that I found interesting is that some people are telling me, you know what, I never used to hear about this stuff, and now everyone's talking about it. And the people that are saying that to me have gray hair. And you know, it's like, okay, well, guess what? You're at middle age, and when you're 21, that, you know, it's a long way away. But when you're over 50, you know what? You can see that arising.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? It's time to talk about it and think about it because it's coming.
I had a close brush with cancer here a few years back. And one of the things that I treasured among my friends was when someone would make me laugh. Because that was the one thing my friends were afraid of. So for some reason, everyone had great respect for the fact that I was sick and that, you know, I was in danger and all that sort of stuff. But every once in a while, someone would say something to me and it would just crack me up. And that was the best, and that was wonderful, you know, to have that instant in which I could forget. You know, and they were the tool that gave me that. A lot of my gratitude goes to people who just made me howl with laughter.
Oh, it's so important.
Yeah.
So people have also asked me, like, what's the target here? And I think if you are grieving, if you know somebody that's grieving, or if you ever think you're going to grieve, I mean, it's really broad from that point of view. If you are grieving, this is a time to embrace that. And if you've just been curious, I tell some people that, you know, like, I don't know if I'm coming to that. And I say, hey, this is your chance. It's all the information with none of the bitter aftertaste.
Mm-hmm.
And so the audience to me is very broad. And come, check it out. And if you've ever been curious about death and dying, here's your chance.
Well, the opportunity comes, when is it? It is
Sunday, February 24th.
Sunday? Okay.
7 p.m. at Northern Light United Church, 11th and B downtown. And if you don't want to join us in person, you can go to northernlightchurch.org and hit the link that says live stream, and you can join us through the magic of the internet. If you do want to go through the internet, please go there prior to that because you need to set up a few
things. Because you have to register. Yeah.
But, yeah, please come out. It will be a memorable experience.
Outstanding. Well, thank you so much. I hope it goes well, and I hope the folks who hear you are as thrilled with your storytelling as I am.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
You bet.
Bye. Take care. Bye.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 22nd of February, 2013. It's the birthday of George Washington, first president of the United States, born Westmoreland County, Virginia, 1732, whose favorite foods were mashed sweet potatoes with coconut, string beans with mushrooms, cream of peanut soup, salt cod, and pineapples. According to John Adams, Washington lost all but one of his teeth by cracking Brazilian nuts between them, and got dentures made out of a hippopotamus tusk, which would fit over his one remaining real tooth, but the dentures were always rubbing against that tooth, and he was constantly in pain, which he used opium to alleviate. He snored loudly in his sleep, and instead of wearing a powdered wig, as others did, he put powder on his own hair. He was not good at spelling. He had a slight speech impediment, and so his inaugural address was very, very short. 133 words, took about 90 seconds to deliver. It's the birthday of the woman who wrote, "My candle burns at both ends, it will not last the night, but ah, my foes, and oh, my friends, it gives a lovely light." Edna St. Vincent Millay, born Rockland, Maine, 1892, lived the bohemian life in Greenwich Village, and wrote, "Safe upon the solid rock the ugly houses stand, come and see my shining palace built upon the sand." Here's a poem for today by Tony Hoagland, entitled Honda Pavarotti. I'm driving on the dark highway when the opera singer on the radio opens his great mouth and the whole car plunges down the canyon of his throat. So the night becomes an aria of stars and exit signs as I steer through the galleries of one dilated Italian syllable after another. I love the passages in which the rich flood of the baritone strains out against the walls of the esophagus, and I love the pauses in which I hear the tenor's flesh labor to inhale enough oxygen to take the next plummet up into the chasm of the violins. In part of the song, it sounds as if the singer is being squeezed by an enormous pair of tongs while his head and legs keep kicking. In part of the song, it sounds as if he is standing in the middle of a coliseum, swinging a 300-pound lion by the tail. The empire of gravity conquered by the empire of aerodynamics. The citadel of pride in flames, and the citizens of weakness celebrating their defeat in chorus. Joy and suffering made one at last, joined in everything a marriage is alleged to be, though I know the woman he is singing for is dead in a foreign language on the stage beside him, though I know his chain mail is made of silver-painted plastic and his mismanagement of money is legendary, as I know I have squandered most of my own life in a haze of trivial distractions, and that I will continue to waste it. But wherever I was going, I don't care anymore, because no place I could arrive at is good enough for this thing made out of experience, but to which experience will never measure up, and that dark and soaring fact is enough to make me renounce the whole world or fall in love with it forever. A poem, Honda Pavarotti, by Tony Hoagland from his collection Donkey Gospel, published by Grey Wolf Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org, and by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Produced by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 27 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next guest is here would you pull one of those microphones right over in front of your face there so everybody can hear you when I introduce you? So this is James Bodkin, and he is an emeritus wildlife biologist with the USGS, the United States Geological Survey. And who would have known that the Geological Survey had wildlife biologists? So you're here as part of the panel discussion that was held earlier this week on Wednesday, I think, of the Sea Otter Symposium.
Right. It was last night, Thursday night.
Okay. But you're doing a special presentation, I think, tonight at Mendenhall Glacier Visitors Center.
That's right.
The fireside lectures, which are at 6:30 and 8:30.
Right.
So what are you going to show us?
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about sea otters. I'm going to talk quite a bit about sea otters. I'm going to talk about their history and their relationships with humans over the past 250 years. I'm going to talk about the conservation of sea otters over the past century and the kind of remarkable success story that we've had in recovering sea otter populations. We're going to talk about how we catch sea otters, and we're going to talk about how the Aleuts caught sea otters 200 and 300 and 500 years ago. We'll talk about the declines in the sea otter populations recently and the Aleutians that are probably a result of predation by killer whales. And we'll talk about how we handle sea otters and how we process them. And we'll talk about some new projects that we're just kind of finishing up that kind of are comparing sea otter populations from the Katmai Coast to the Big Sur Coast of California.
Sea otters are really closely tied with the early history of Alaska. The thing that brought the Russians into the Aleutian Islands at first was a huge quest for sea otter pelts. Why were they so attractive to the Russians? What were they? Did they have some special properties?
Well, their primary property is the density of the fur, the density of the hairs that are in the fur. Sea otters use air to insulate themselves from the water rather than fat. All the other marine mammals use blubber layers, but sea otters use a thin layer of air that's trapped in their fur. And it's because of the qualities of the fur that humans valued them, and they primarily were going to Asian markets for the quality of their pelt.
And then they moved out of the Aleutians as the primary source and moved on into Kodiak Island and then down to Sitka. Was that because they had killed off so many of the sea otters out in the Aleutians?
Yeah, essentially, you know, the harvest started in Asia and off the Kamchatka coast and the Kuril Islands, and then, you know, just basically systematically moved across the Aleutian Archipelago and the Alaska Peninsula and then southward along the west coast of North America, basically exterminating the species as they went along. And it was only by probably fortuitous that a few, very small number of animals remained in a very few locations by the time the fur harvest was over in 1911.
Now, in the southeast Alaska, I think they introduced 403 sea otters, and then a few years later, there's as many as 25,000 of them. So prolific breeding, probably because of the lack of a predator?
That and the fact that they had been absent for such a long period of time in southeast Alaska that their prey populations had increased to tremendous levels, you know, levels that wouldn't have occurred if this predator had stayed in the system. Things like sea urchins and clams and mussels and crabs, you know, they all expanded their populations. And so when we put sea otters back in this system, they had basically the shelves of the grocery store were full, and they were readily available. So I think that's largely what fueled the growth in this population.
Yeah. Now, this orca whale, what evidence are we basing the idea that the orca whale is the primary predator up in the Aleutians?
Well, the primary evidence is visual observations of killer whales consuming sea otters. Now, that being said, we didn't watch them eat 80,000 sea otters, which is about how many are missing.
Yeah.
You know, we saw a very small number of animals get consumed, but we did. And so there was direct evidence of, you know, through observations. And there was also a lack of evidence for any of the other kind of suspected culprits in a big decline like that. You know, we didn't see any carcasses on the beaches. The animals were in good condition. There was plentiful food for them there. So there was a lack of evidence for everything else, and there was these observations of killer whales eating sea otters. But one of the more interesting pieces of evidence had to do with the response in sea otters' behavior as this event took place over the course of a decade. And what happened was, you know, sea otters typically, when they're disturbed, they will dive and go out to sea. I mean, they'll dive and go deep and take their refuge in the ocean. Over the past 10 to 20 years, what we've seen is when you disturb a sea otter out in the Aleutians now, the first thing it does is it goes ashore. You know, it escapes a marine predator. So there's a strong behavioral change in their response to a disturbance. And then also they change their distribution. So right now when you go out to the Aleutians, the only place that you're going to find sea otters are in, you know, very shallow waters, protected lagoons, or over very, you know, intertidal areas where, you know, these large predators don't have access. So there's a kind of a broad range of evidence that all pointed towards killer whales.
Fishermen are not friends of the sea otter. There's a lot of ill feeling towards sea otters because I think they tend to clean out nets and stuff like that. How big is this problem in Southeast Alaska particularly?
It's a big problem. So in the absence of sea otters over the past 200 or so years, these invertebrate populations have grown and grown in abundance and grown in size. And, you know, in recent decades, and there's been commercial and recreational and subsistence fisheries developed on things like Dungeness crab and clams and gooey duck clams, in particular, sea urchins and sea cucumbers. A variety of different fisheries existed, developed in the absence of sea otters. And so as sea otters were introduced and as they're kind of recolonizing Southeast Alaska, they're kind of coming into conflict and competition with humans over some of these shellfish that fisheries have been developed on.
So does any of the work, I was unable to go to this, to the panel discussion, but has any of the work of any of the scientists looked at how to deal with that problem? Is there any move toward trying to achieve some peace here?
You know, the science is really designed to look at cause and effect, and you know how that effect is managed is really a policy or a management action, and all that the science can really do is try to inform the management, and that's so we don't kind of get into the kind of the questions of how you mitigate the problems. All we're trying to do is define the problems and define kind of the information that will allow people to make decisions about how they proceed with policy and actions.
So, Jamie, you're doing a talk at two talks tonight. One at 6:30, one at 8:30. Obviously, you are a qualified expert on sea otters. I'm expecting this will be a really interesting pair of presentations. They are taking place as the Fireside Lectures at Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. Encourage everyone to come out and hear a real expert talk to us about sea otters in Southeast Alaska and around the world.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Okay. Thank you.
about 46 minutes before, or 15, 16 minutes before 4 o'clock. 46 minutes before 4? Yeah, amazing. 16 minutes before 4, you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. A quick note here. My next guest is here to tell us about an event that's coming up, and I believe this is this the first annual?
It is, indeed.
Yeah, this is Megan Grunow, and she's telling us about a thing called the Masquerade Ball. It's going to be at Rockwell, I guess, this weekend, right?
Yeah, tomorrow upstairs in our ballroom at 8 o'clock.
In every movie about there's any scene done in Austria, there's always a masquerade ball, you know, with usually Mozart dancing around the floor going crazy and all that sort of thing. So what do you got planned?
Well, we will have a couple crazy dancers. Uh-huh. That will be there. It's a surprise performances. They're just going to come out of nowhere. We have four of them planned. We're going to have a great cocktail list with themed beverages, and decorations are going to be pretty phenomenal. It's looking really good, and it's going to be a lot of fun raising money for Rotaract, which is a younger division of Rotary.
18 to 30 professionals.
You got it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you do quite a bit of work around the community. The money from this event is one of your big fundraisers, right?
Rockwell's? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So what kinds of projects is the money going for?
They do all kinds of fun ones. One of my favorites is the chili cook-off for Shelterbox.
Okay.
It's a really fun event for Juno. You get to try everybody's chilies, and then all of the money goes to this group called Shelterbox, which is quite a literal name. It's a shelter and food and warmth that all goes into a box, and it's sent to whatever relief needs it most. And it's fun and for a great cause. They also do the Fest for Breasts, Adult Prom. They do the Rachel McLeod Christmas Box Project every year. I used to be their PR chair.
So you know them all.
I do.
The publicity for this event says do not be fashionably late.
Yes.
Why not?
Because of the surprise performances.
Oh, so one of them
they're
is right
wrap
at the beginning.
Up. Okay. Yeah, right at the beginning. It's within the first hour and 20 minutes or so.
So, your partner just walked in and hi there.
Angela Gowdy, president of Rotaract.
Hi, Angela.
Hello.
So we've been talking about the Masquerade Ball. We've just got a couple of minutes more to make sure we cover all the bases here. And Megan has already told us about most of the things that are going on. I wanted to, and you mentioned another fundraiser. I wanted to know what projects Rotaract is looking forward to that they'll be using these funds for.
Well, our next project is the chili cook-off for Shelterbox.
Right, and so these funds will assist in that process as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
All right, and so Megan told us about those. And then, do you have anything else scheduled coming up?
Yeah, we have an adult prom sort of thing in the works. We might be changing it up this year. We're not quite sure. We haven't said anything with that. And then the next big project is going to be Oktoberfest for Breast, but that's in October, so it's a ways away.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
But all of these events take funds, and so this is one of your major fundraiser events here. So the Masquerade Ball starts at 7 o'clock. Do not be fashionably late.
8 o'clock.
Thank you. Okay. You should check your website. It says 7. So it starts at 8 o'clock, and it's at Rockwell.
Right.
And if you're late at all, you're going to miss at least part of the surprise performances that are going on through the whole thing. Prizes for best costume.
Great prizes. Kirsten's Pond donated an amazing stay, as well as Vanity. She's the new, she does facials downtown.
Outstanding.
And, bubbly.
Wonderful. Okay, well, thank you very much for telling us all about this.
And it's a $15 donation to Rotaract.
Yeah, and that's full cover charge for the whole thing. And who's doing the music?
DJ White Chocolate.
White Chocolate,
DJ.
Yeah, okay, good enough. Okay, all right, well, thank you much for coming down. Sorry we only had a short time to talk about this. Thank you. Mark Stofa is here, and he's going to tell us about an event that is also coming up right away. It's on Saturday, and this is the Juneau Watershed Partnership Film Festival. And Mark tells me that this is a collection of films that's available from a national source, and then we get all of the films here and have a committee that views them and then makes a selection. So you're going to be showing, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 for young folks, I think, and then from 6:30 to 9:30 you have a longer program of films for adults.
That's right. They and the films are, the longest film that we have on any of these is, it looks like 38 minutes for the kids, and the longer ones are around 30 minutes. There's one or two of those for the all ages section. So these aren't real long films. They don't, you don't have to, if you don't get there right away, it's not like you missed the whole thing. You'll just be on to the next film.
Yeah. So Mark, where is this?
This is at the Jack, and it's, the children's events start from 4 o'clock till 6:30, and there'll be films and face painting and games and activities for the kids. And then the all ages festival starts at 6:30 and goes till 9:30. And we also have a big silent auction that goes with that.
Mm-hmm. So the films that we're going to see, what kinds of topics did the committee select?
Well, for the kids part, one film is about a young girl that has part of her family in a New York forest and part in the Louisiana Gulf Coast, and that kind of talks about what happened during the Gulf oil spill and what she did to try and raise some money for Audubon bird rescue through some paintings that she made. There's another one that's about African 11-year-old in Africa who planted thousands of trees and then moved that project on to Germany, and it was just to benefit to sequester carbon dioxide, mm-hmm. essentially, was a theme of that. Another one is about, this one's from Oregon, and it is about just a journey through the Cascade Mountains and sort of a tour through the water resources, forests, and the coastal communities of the Pacific Northwest there. The feature film is Watermelon Magic, and that one is a documentary about a young family, a young girl on a family farm that grows a patch of watermelons to sell at market. And the final one is Moonwalk. This one's about a desert landscape with massive full moon as a backdrop. And this was one of the best feature films at the Port Townsend Film Festival. And again, this one's, that was the best film, feature film, but it's only 4 minutes. So even the kids can even usually pay attention for that long.
Yeah, so these films are part of what you're calling the Kids Festival, but
right.
It sounds like some of the content is well worthy of an adult's attention.
It is, and like the adult films, too, aren't like they're rated anything more than G or PG. They're not.
Right.
They're just, I think, longer and probably maybe more, I don't know about mature subjects, but just a few of those. One of them is about cross-country skiing on Baffin Island in the northern, the Canadian Arctic. Another one I saw that looked like it'd be, I guess, interesting is the one about a desert life, about a guy who spends his life living and climbing and Indian Creek, Utah. It says he has no job, no bank account, and no house but his camper. And but climbing at some point became more than a hobby for him. And it says a desert life's a portrait of a man who truly lives his passion and a tribute to the desert. So that one's about the Utah desert.
Yeah. There was an oddly titled film in the right after the intermission on the in the evening called Song of the Spindle that had to do with whaling, or whales, and I was curious about that. Do you have any detail on that one?
Yeah, that one is actually an animation film about a man and a sperm whale who have a conversation about who is smarter. And this one, I guess it goes through the upsides and downsides of human and cetacean brains, but and each one comes to appreciation of the other.
Oh, okay. Well, that sounds like a really interesting subject for an animated film.
Yeah, yeah. And one that's, I guess it's pretty interesting to me because I'm on the Watershed Partnership and I was just down in Ketchikan to a fish culture conference. It's called Facing Climate Change. It's about oyster farmers in Washington. The Nisbet farm had to move from Wallapa Bay over to Hawaii because of ocean acidification, and the hatcheries down there are having a hard time making spat oysters, the young oysters that you would put out on an oyster farm like they have in Prince of Wales. And right now there's a research, it's a floating house, I guess, or a floating lab that's down in Ketchikan that is funded, I think, through the state and through some grants, but they're trying to figure out how to do the hatchery business up here because it looks we don't have the acidification issues yet, and it could actually be this acidification problem down there could be a boom to some Alaskan industries if we can figure out how to get through all the tricks of rearing oyster and gooey duck spat like that up here, because then we would be able to start selling down there actually, because they're short on the getting the spat to the oyster farms down there.
Maybe the next wild salmon campaign coming out of Alaska. Huh?
Yeah, I guess climate change is happening, but it doesn't necessarily mean there won't be opportunities for everybody.
Mark, there's a fee for going to the thing, but it goes to a good cause. Tell us some of the activities that the partnership is involved in.
Yeah, we're Juneau Watershed Partnership. We sponsor things like and work the stream cleanup events and beach cleanups, community field trips, and we have activities through the schools. We're not a political organization. We're a nonprofit community resource for public agencies and the private industry to talk about water and watershed issues and implement planning that protects our waterways for ourselves and the fish we eat. So it's really a partnership between Juneau Watershed Partnerships work with groups that come in and do any kind of development or anything that we can work with people to develop responsibly so that any kind of runoff and things like that will not negatively impact the watersheds. They're just engineered in the right way to be done right. There's for the festival, this year, Alaska Brewing Company here in town, the Alaska Pacific Bank, and Kai Environmental Services are the ones who sponsored it. And we also had support from Corvus Designs, Alaska Litho, and the national sponsors. This watershed Wild and Scenic Film Festival is going on sort of all over the country, and those are bigger pieces like Patagonia, Cliff Bar, Osprey PAX, Grist.org, Clean Canteen, and the Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. They're like the national sponsors that help get these a variety of movies out to people all over the country. It's $12 to get in for adults, $8 for students and seniors, and for children under 3 are free. We also, this year, we're hoping to get more members on the Juneau Watershed Partnership, and a $30 entry will get you a ticket for the film, a beer ticket, as we do have beer there. It'd be a great thing for people going to that masquerade party. They could come to see the start of our film festival at 6:30 and watch a few movies before they head up to that. I think that'd be a great night here. And a one-year membership to our Juneau Watershed Partnership, so we're hoping to get a lot of some members at this thing as well.
Mark, sounds like a wonderful event. It starts at 4 o'clock on Saturday, February 23rd at the Jack with the Kids Festival, and then 6:30 with the All Ages Festival, probably be out around 10 o'clock tonight. And supports the Juneau Watershed Partnership. Thanks for telling us about it.
Thanks.
Well, that wraps up Juneau Afternoon for today. Vic Fisher's talking tonight up at the campus at 7 p.m. in Egan Lecture Hall, and Saturday at Holy Trinity at 7 p.m., and a bunch of other events going on over the weekend. Monday's show will be with Joan Pardis, and she has Rabbi Dov Gartenberg coming on to discuss Passover. Nora and Richard Dauenauer will join her from the Downtown Library. They're doing a Thursday reading. City Manager Kim Kiefer will update on CBJ activities, and Jason Smart will be here with nominations from the Rasmussen Foundation Distinguished Artist Award. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also broadcast on translators throughout the area in the Valley and Auk Bay. It's K276AF at 103.1. Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269AO, 101.7. Gustavus is on K201 AM at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. And Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, we're on K210AS at 89.9.